and welcome. Happy New Year. We haven't met for 2 months instead of 1 month due to the weather and the snow and the ice and the winter. So for those of you listening to this on the internet, that's why there's no December meditation podcast. So welcome back. Looking briefly at the January monthly planner. Today is the 4th of January, Tuesday. It's a double gray day, and today is the new moon, as a matter of fact. And it's double gray because the moon is with Mars and with Rahu, both in Sagittarius. As most of you know, the planner is to be used to plan important work, business, purchases. It's not so much a daily horoscope for anybody in particular. It's just a general planner to pick the best days, to begin things, to buy things, to plan important work. So gray days, double gray days, they're best avoided. Bronze days are average days. We have a couple of gold days coming up. Monday the 10th till Wednesday the 12th. Now we're using, of course, Irish time and British time here where we are. It's a little bit different from the other time zones, but those are gold days. Then we have a few silver days from the 15th to the 17th, which are also very, very favorable. And then we have more silver days from the 19th to the 21st. And then just gray and bronze from there on in. Bronze are also fine. They're average days. But gray, the last several days of the month are all gray, so best to be avoided for planning important work. Okay. We recently had a complete total lunar eclipse on December 21st, well, 20th, 21st, depending what time zone you live in. There's actually a minor solar eclipse this morning. Now, I'm not going to talk much about that one right now, but I'm going to talk about the lunar eclipse that fell on the solstice on the 21st. I think it's been 400 years since an eclipse fell on the same day as the solstice. So that's kind of interesting in and of itself. According to Vedic astrology and Vedic thought, according to yoga philosophy, an eclipse is largely a negative occurrence because it means that the luminaries, the planets that bring the light, namely sun and moon, become overshadowed or eclipsed. Now, of course, they say that it's due to the Earth's shadow, and they give different explanations for it. But always what we find, astrologically speaking, is Rahu or Ketu are going to be there. And generally, when the sun is eclipsed, it's Rahu, who is in conjunction with the sun. And when the moon is eclipsed, it's Ketu, in conjunction with the moon. So that's what we had on that day. Eclipse effects are not normally felt on the day of the eclipse, but they are felt subsequently. This particular eclipse lasted for 5.5 hours in duration, and the total eclipse was about an hour and 15 minutes, but 5.5 hours from beginning to end, which means that the influences or effects should be felt for the next 5.5 months. in the world and in different parts of the world. Which parts? The parts where the eclipse could be seen. Because eclipses can be seen in different parts of the world and not in others. So I won't list those. I don't have those in front of me. But if you saw the eclipse then, or you have access to seeing it, then it could apply to us. So I just want to read a couple things. This article is on my website under Planetary Events, if you want to read it more carefully. Rahu and Ketu are known as the Chaya Graha, which means shadow planets. And since their purpose is to carry and project the shadow upon the other planets, this they accomplish both on the personal or individual level and the collective or world level. Rahu and Ketu reveal the force or nature of the shadow or negative behavior pattern and its consequences so that it can be recognized, exposed to the light of day, and subsequently resolved and removed. So it's meant to point out certain behaviors, mindsets, beliefs, conditioning that is not progressive, not positive, may have the wrong intention, so that we can see it, and having come to terms with it, because many times we don't see it or we deny it, and we may deny for years, as we do. So it's meant to bring that shadow to the fore. Oh, well, here, take a look at this. That's his job. So theoretically, it's negative, but ultimately, it's meant to be positive. If what needs to be changed becomes changed, if we come to terms with the shadow, simply put. Now, the moon was in the sign of Gemini, according to Vedic calculation. Gemini is ruled by Mercury. And it was in the constellation of Mrigashira, the deer. Mrigashira means deer face, or deer head. So that's the deer. And Mrigashira constellation is a Deva constellation. Constellations are divided into three. There's 27 constellations in the 360-degree zodiac. Each one extends for 13 degrees, 20 minutes. 1320 times 27 is 360 degrees. And they span the 12 signs. And in Vedic astrological understanding, the signs, such as Aries, Taurus, Gemini, derive their subtle influences from the constellations, which is the backdrop of fixed stars behind the signs, the zodiac divisions. In Western astrological thought, they don't really know that. They don't know about it. They don't use it. It's sort of beyond their scope. So, the constellation is Mrigashira. It's Deva. It's divided into, they're divided into three types. Deva means godly or enlightened. There's nine of those constellations. Nara means human, or in a state of yearning and desire. That's what humans do, by the way, mostly. So there's nine of those. And Raksha, which is, Raksha literally means demonic. They're not really demonic. It just means more materialistic and less improved. So people who might resort to intimidation and manipulation to get their needs met. So there's nine of those. So this constellation, Mriga, or Mrigashira, is Deva. So we know that eclipse has a negative effect. So what would be an example of devas in our society? Pardon? No, they would think themselves an example of devas. No, go higher. Correct. Priests. The priesthood. Okay. Priesthood, the clergy. So what would we... Let's interpret here. Interpret this for me. What would happen to the clergy in the coming 5.5 months? They would come under... attack, scrutiny, criticism. Exactly. You see how it works? For to whatever extent they're carrying or projecting the shadow, that will be attacked, or they will come under scrutiny, closer scrutiny, in that period. Well, that seems to be a theme at hand anyway these days. So to hear that that might continue, it should be no surprise. Right? But that's one example of what we're talking about. Now, if we use the symbol, we interpret the symbol. Symbol is deer. What is deer a symbol of? Not just the ones that come into our garden every night to dine. What's a deer a symbol of?
Heart.
What else?
Affection.
I'm looking for something else. Innocence. No? Aren't they very innocent? Sort of pure and innocent? So if that's the case, we pretty much agree on that, no? So who will come under attack? The innocent.
But why would the innocent come under attack?
Because it's an eclipse. And the shadow overpowers the light.
Innocents are innocent.
Do you think the innocent never come under attack? You think no one's ever been prosecuted who's been innocent? Sitting in a jail cell? Okay, so you see how this works? So now I'm going to give you a whole list of things here that I've derived from my... that I came up with. Now, will all of these happen? No way of knowing. They're all negative, by the way, so I'm going to tell you that ahead of time. I'll tell you something positive later. But they're all negative, and this is what could take place. Increased anxiety, stress, worry, tension, fear, and panic in people. That doesn't sound so like a stretch. That's not a stretch at this point. Increase, and that's because we're in the constellation Mrigashira, and we are in the sign of Gemini, which is ruled by Mercury, which is the nervous system. Increase in nervous disorders, nerve diseases, including Alzheimer's. Increase in thyroid problems, throat afflictions, and thymus gland complications. Increase in impulsive, compulsive, fickle, and excitable behaviors. Increase in mental fatigue, chronic fatigue syndrome, and weariness. Increase difficulty in effective communication and agreement. Mercury is all about communication and agreement. Increase in selfish and self-centered behavior. Well, we've had a pretty good dose of that recently. Increase in innocent, unsuspecting, and gentle people being targeted and preyed upon by predators. who just bailed out the banks? Those people, largely. Increase in sexual degradation. Lovers and people in love will be publicly condemned. Now you see that more often, pardon? That generally you'll find in Muslim societies. They stone them or whip them. That sort of thing, right? Increased problems and costs for energy, power, electricity, telephones, computers, internet, and communications technologies. Negative effect on the book publishing business. Negative effect on musicians and the music business, because the constellation rules that. Engineering failures and incompetence to come to light, especially regarding the construction of buildings, highways, dams, and bridges. Surgeons will be taken to task for their sloppy and careless work. Happens a lot here in Ireland. That's what I see in the newspaper. Yeah, I should mention to the people and listening to this on the podcast that we have nurses here in the room. Prices of textiles and clothing will increase. Agents, representatives, sales and marketing personnel, and brokers will come under fire. Thieves, con men, hustlers, and grifters will be on the increase. So I guess Fianna Fáil will still be in power. No, there's no way in the world that'll happen. No way. Well, I mean, according to Ireland's chart for 2010 to 2011, the current party in power will not remain in power. So we'll see if that happens, but that has nothing to do with this. Prices of fruits, flowers, fragrances, and perfumes will see a dramatic rise. Well, let's see if it's right. Products of the sea, such as fish, will be threatened and or rise in price. Are shipping prices going up, Frank? Are they stable? Well, if fuel, oil goes up, they go up, no?
Well, the freight rates go up as well.
So that would make sense from that point of view, no? gemstones, particularly emeralds, green tourmalines, aquamarines, and green jade, will shoot up in price and in value. Telling this to my wife in particular, who's a gemologist. Ambassadors and government messengers will be subjected to criticism and increased danger. Embassies will be threatened. I think just a couple days ago, the embassies in Ivory Coast, they're thinking of shutting them down and removing their personnel because they're on the brink.
Why would you want to be there in the first place is the question.
Well, if there's Western embassies in those countries, that means they have some kind of resources, would be my guess. Soldiers will be killed in greater numbers. Forests and rainforests will be subjected to increased devastation. Greater numbers of animals and birds in the wild will be wiped out. Now, I just wanted to comment on this computers, internet, and communications technologies. Interesting thing I read, actually somebody sent it to me, was that this WikiLeaks thing that happened, they leaked all of this information from the U.S. Diplomatic Corps, wherever it came from, different places. And but it's none of the information was all that compelling, really. I mean, it's not going to upset any government in any major way. this person had claimed that it was all done on purpose by the government, by the U.S. government, to say that we are at such great risk now from people like the WikiLeaks guy, Mr. Assange, that we have to clamp down now on the internet and control things more, which is the whole direction that the U.S. is going in. It's becoming less and less an open and free society because the government is stepping in and controlling things. So this gives them a reason. So they gave you some examples in this article, and I clicked on different sites to see if I could see them, and they're all shut down by the Department of Justice in the U.S. You can't even access WikiLeaks. So they shut down whatever they want to shut down. So there goes your freedom of speech, you know, freedom of information. So that's interesting. Okay. What are you supposed to do during an eclipse? No, it's not the first time. I mean, there are usually about 4 to 6 eclipses a year. What's coincidental is that it happened on the solstice. That's the first time in 400 years. What that means, I'm not sure. In Vedic times, many thousands of years ago, it was the custom to enter a river during an eclipse. Excuse me. I have a bit of a cough. Particularly a sacred river such as the Ganges or the Dargal or the ocean or other body of water, and chant mantras and offer prayers for purification for the duration of the eclipse. Solar and lunar eclipses are generally very inauspicious, not favorable, with certain rare exceptions. It is nonetheless an advantageous opportunity for fasting, prayer, and worshiping God. Fasting should be observed for the whole period of the eclipse in order to nullify the reactions of past negative deeds or egocentric activities. It is also recommended to give in charity to the poor as much as possible during the time of a lunar or solar eclipse. If you cannot afford to give in charity, then simply give charity within your mind. That is, envision yourself doing it just the way you would on the physical plane. The spiritual benefit for you will be the same. It's non-different. Whatever you give in your mind, and you're giving it out of the goodness of your heart, with the right intention, you will get spiritually the same benefit. Even if you don't have the wherewithal to, you know, give vast amounts of wealth. The other day we had a meditation. What? How much wealth did we offer in that meditation? Millions and millions of dollars in offering, right? Or billions. It was a lot. There was a lot. There's no limit, if you can imagine it. Pregnant women should never look at an eclipse, since it is thought to have a potentially negative effect on the health of the fetus. So, I don't know if that has happened, but that is the recommendation. Any questions or comments on the eclipse?
Last
5.5 months. 5.5 months, yeah. Since 21st December.
Mm-hmm.
So there are the predictions. Now you won't remember them all, but you might remember 2 or 3 or more. Let's see if they happen. Let's see what happens. I just got this email today, and I thought I would share it with you because it's pretty amazing. Have you seen the movie Ghost? Remember the movie Ghost with Demi Moore and Patrick Swayze, who's now, God bless him, left his body recently? The Potter's Wheel. Yeah, that was a nice scene, wasn't it? That's memorable. I remember that, yeah. So remember that when the bad guys in the movie, because they had killed him off at the beginning, he was a ghost from the very beginning. The bad guys, when they would die, these very dark characters would come to collect them and take them to hell or to judgment or some dark place. And obviously, it was clear what the intention was. Well, according to Vedic understanding and yoga philosophy, though, there are such guys, and they're called the Yama Dutas. Yama is the name of the demigod or angel, if you like, archangel, if you like that parlance better, who's in charge of death. He's the guy that's got to go collect the souls. He may not do it himself, but he's in charge of the whole thing. Well, he actually has minions, you know. He doesn't run around doing it. And these minions are the Yama, his name is Yama, Dutas. Duta means messenger. The messengers of the angel of death, right? And they're not pleasant guys because they yank the soul out of the body. They say they got it like in a noose. They carry a noose and grab you and off you go, right? On the other side of the fence are the Vishnu Dutas. Vishnu is God, simply. Vishnu means God who's all-pervading, lives everywhere. And the Vishnu Dutas are very, they're light beings, and if they show up when you're about to cross over, you'll be a happy soul because there's a lot of good stuff coming for you. You must have done some good things. Marcus, yeah. So that's the difference here, Yama Dutas and Vishnu Dutas. This happened in San Diego at the Krishna temple there. And there was an Indian man named Mr. Prakash. And Mr. Prakash would go to the temple and, you know, see the deity and do some chanting and whatever. But Mr. Prakash, he really wasn't into it too much. He went because his wife went. And the family went. You know, the Indians are very much into that sort of thing. Even when they're not into it, they're into it. They do it. And but he wasn't devout. Let's just put it this way. So one day, Mr. Prakash had a severe heart attack, and he was rushed to the hospital. And during the surgery, he almost passed away on four different occasions. He almost died. This is an Indian man, Mr. Prakash, in San Diego. It was touch and go, and he slipped into a coma. He remained that way for several weeks afterward. One of the Krishna devotees connected to the temple was requested by Mrs. Prakash, please come and visit her husband in the hospital, even though he was in a coma, and come and pray for him and chant some mantra, something, you know. It's like bring the priest to the hospital. He's in coma. So this Krishna devotee, his name is Badri. And he went and dutifully obliged. Several times he went to the bedside and he read, like Bhagavad Gita, he read some nice book, and he chanted mantras to Mr. Prakash, who is unconscious. Then one day, this Budri got a call from Mrs. Prakash saying, "Please, please come quickly to the hospital. My husband has come out of the coma." This is several weeks. "But he only wants to speak to you. He doesn't want anyone else, just you." So Budri goes, and when he goes there, he finds some relatives and hospital staff gathered around the bedside of Mr. Prakash, who's now conscious. When he sees Budri, Mr. Prakash begins to speak. He says, "Budri, four times they came. Four times they came." The relatives present thought he was talking about them. "Yes, we came many times. We were here. Coming, going. But you were in coma. You did not know." Like this. The relatives present thought he was talking about them. "Yes, we came several times." Mr. Prakash shook his head to indicate, no, that's not what he's talking about. "No, Budri, they came four times." So then the hospital staff said, yeah, we almost lost you four times. You were in a coma, but somehow we saved you." Again, he shook his head, no. Four times they came. Budri started to realize what he was referring to. Who came, Prabhu? Who came? The Vishnu Dutas? The messengers of Vishnu? No, it was the bad people, the Yama Dutas. They came the first time to take me away. But I told them, I am simply dependent on Lord Krishna. So they went away. Now, this is the guy, he's not so much a devotee of God, but he's telling the dark force here, coming to grab his soul, no, I'm dependent on Krishna. So, so they went away, first time. So this is him dying each time, or his mini death, or whatever he's having there. Then they came a second time. Again, I told them, do whatever you must, but I am simply depending on the Lord, on Krishna. They went away again. Then they came the third time and told me they would take me away. I told them, you do whatever you must do, but I am dependent on Krishna. They left again. Then they came the fourth time, but this time some of the good people came as well. The Vishnu Dutas also came. He's got them all there. When the bad people saw them, they said, okay, we have no jurisdiction here. And they left. Because the higher power had come in. Then, at that moment, I came out of my coma. He called Budri close to him and said, you know, Budri, I was never serious about God, about prayers, about the puja. But I am now. 100%. So Mr. Prakash recovered and became one of the most enthusiastic and humble servants of Krishna to attend the temple. So, that's the story. Interesting story, huh? You remember this movie, Ghost? You ever see this movie?
No.
No, you see your
scene. It's quite cool.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Because they have the Yamadutas in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Remember?
And I was one of the guys in the Facebook that reported it, and he said that there was a case against Lord Krishna in Poland, and one of the nuns. One
of the nuns, a Catholic nun, said that these people, she brought a case, these people are worshipping this debaucher, Krishna. They think he's God, but he's nothing but a debaucher. He actually married 16,000 wives, 16,000 women, which is true. But the circumstance was that 16,000 princesses were locked up in a prison when this demon, I don't remember his name now, I lost his name. He captured their husbands in battle, locked them up, killed some of them, and then took all the wives, all the princesses, and locked them up. So all the husbands were eventually killed, and then Krishna came and freed them all these women. And they said, well, who will protect us now? All our husbands have been killed. What man will want us? Because in those days, you know, it wouldn't be looked upon very well, even though they didn't do anything wrong. So Krishna took them all as his wives. So the nun in the lawsuit is saying that Krishna is nothing but a debaucher. And so they go to court. And the Krishna's devotees, they have an attorney, obviously. So the attorney gets the nun who's bringing the case on the stand. And he says, good day, sister. Would you please repeat your vows out loud for the court? She turns white. No. Sister, please, will you repeat your vow? The vow you took when you became a nun out loud for the court? No. He says, well then, Your Honor, may I do it? May I repeat her vow? Let me read it for you. That I will become the wife of Jesus, and I will dedicate my life to my husband, Jesus. And how many women take this vow, sister? More than 16,000? Yes, so many more. So, boom, case dismissed. You know. That one?
Yes.
Yeah, well, it was a meritless case. Now, speaking of the subject of death, and it is considered to be excellent karma, I mean, the best karma, to know when you'll die. Because who knows when they're going to die? Pretty much nobody. So if you actually know when you're going to die, you can prepare. When, you know, in this world, even if you know when the teacher is going to give you a test at school, that's very valuable information. Because you can prepare for that test if you choose. Or not. So, when they go to die, but we mean like, it, you know, kind of ahead of time. You know, we consider it a bad thing when people get a terminal illness and the doctor tells them you have 6 months to a year to live. So it's a tragedy on the one hand, but on the other hand, that's very valuable information. You can choose to turn things around and refocus yourself, right? So that's what we're talking about.
What about people who suicide?
I'm going to die now.
Yeah, but they go to dark places because they're in a dark state of mind. Mm-hmm. You don't go to a bright place when you're in a dark state of mind. You know, you become what you're thinking of. You become like what you're thinking of at the time of death. Whatever you focus on at the time of death, that's where you go, or that's what you become. That's a fact. So if you're suicidal, you're not in the best state of mind to advance your cause in the next life or in the next world. How are you? And that state of mind, actually, you don't get rid of it. You just get rid of the physical situation. The state of mind goes with you. Okay. This is a short story, but very interesting. I liked it anyway. There was a king called Maharaj Katvanga. Maharaj means the great king. Katvanga is his name. Do you want to put a couple of... shall we put a couple on there? Bernadette,
yep.
Get you warm. So... Maharaj Katvanga was, this would have been, you know, not in Kali Yuga. This would have been Treta Yuga or Dwapara Yuga, I don't know when. He was invited by the demigods in the higher planets to go to the higher planets and help fight off some demons from some negative forces. And, he, as a king, he fought the battles to the full satisfaction of demigods. He was a brave guy. So then they won the battles, and the demigods, being fully satisfied with him, wanted to give him a benediction, a blessing for material enjoyment. Well, let's give you a reward. You know, you already helped us here. What would you like? Well, then we think, well, you know, they're living in the heavenly realms. What can't you have? You know, this guy's going to choose himself a nice little package of some kind. But he didn't. He said, being very much alert to his prime duty, he inquired from the demigods about his remaining duration of life. He said, well, I really only want to know one thing. When am I going to die? And he said, what? Why would you want to know that? It can give you riches and enjoyment and heavenly girls and so many nice things are available. No, I don't want that. This means that he was not as anxious to accumulate some material benefit from the demigods as he was to prepare himself for his next life. He was informed by the demigods, however, that his life would last only a moment longer. He had a moment left. Mm-hmm. The king at once left the heavenly kingdom, which is always full of material enjoyment of the highest standard, and coming down to the earth, took ultimate shelter of God. In other words, he began to meditate on God and pray and devote his moment, his final moment, to God. He was successful in his great attempt and achieved liberation. This attempt, even for a moment, by the saintly king, was successful because he was always alert to his prime duty. So, what that tells us, now he was a guy, he was alert, and he was God conscious to begin with, but the other thing it shows you is if you can focus on God even the last moment of your life, that can turn everything around for you. even if you lived a less than ideal life, and even you saw with Mr. Prakash, you know, he was not living such a great life, but he made a plea on behalf of, oh no, I'm with Krishna. That kept driving these guys off. So it says in the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita that whatever you focus on at death, that's what you get, that's what you achieve, that's what you attain, that state of being, that's where you go. So you say, well, look, I can just do whatever I want all my life. I can do whatever nonsense I like. And then right at the end, I'll just focus on this other thing. Well, theoretically, it's possible. But generally, we humans, it doesn't work like that. Whatever we are conditioned to, whatever we do mostly, that's what we end up focusing on at the time of death. Questions, comments, near-death experiences, whatever you'd like to tell us about. Anybody?
I had a dream last night with a place where I had a big emerald on my middle finger, and I was trying to protect it, and I was in my old house, my family home, and there was a man who had been really good at protecting me and the house. And all of a sudden,
you knew this man in real life?
No, I've never seen him before. So he had this funny silencer on, like a leather thing, which had a gun connected to it. And I hit the bullet.
I mean, yeah.
You saw too many movies.
So these fellas were trying to break into the house. And this happened a lot, actually. So I was trying to find the ammunition. And I was also, he was a little bit not with it. So I was trying to say to him, you may have killed before, but you really need to be sharp, because I think it was a bit like, yeah, you still have to be aware, because you may think you're at a level of whatever, but you're not, so you have to keep being aware. Like, so I got
you told him that.
Yeah, it was like, and so I gave him the ammunition, and I was trying to hold the door, and the door in this house, in my family home, didn't have a padlock, but this one actually did. I was a bit relieved, because that managed to hold them back a bit. But I don't know. But then my ring, it just turned into gel. It wasn't an emerald, so I was very disappointed. That was my dream.
We need to lay off the drug.
Well, I don't take it. But I have had a lot since then. I'm trying to protect, or I'm like someone who's an army person, and I'm continually having to help the people who are fighting. Or,
well, I wonder if you have it a lot. Maybe it's a past life recollection. Maybe that's what you did. Maybe you were a soldier or a policeman or something or other. Did you have a lot of thieves breaking to that family home?
No, because my mum had it all like secured. It was like Fort Knox.
Is it only since your parents died did you have the dream?
No, I always had the story that the house was being broken into, even though I never broke into it.
Did somebody whip everybody else into a frenzy about being broken into?
Yeah.
Who did that?
My parents.
Regularly.
Like, yeah, it was a fear. It was like fear that we were going to go get broken into.
Right. So, and that you had throughout your lifetime?
Yeah.
There you go.
That's great.
There's the well, I don't know if it's great, but there's the answer. So you have an imprint.
Fantastic. So how do I get rid of it? So how do I? I think because I'm in K2, so obviously that's coming up to the fore.
K2, in the 12th house where you have it, means things will bubble up from the subconscious. And these are shadow things. We were talking about Ra and K2 carrying the shadow earlier in eclipse. So that's a shadow experience, because I'm not saying that people can't break into a house. They can. They do. But they never did at your house. So it wasn't a founded fear, it was an unfounded fear. It's not like it happened. You know, and they couldn't because places like Fort Knox anyway. So it still has been imprinted upon your psyche since you were small.
So you just keep chanting.
You can chant, you can meditate on that and start to reprogram it, rewrite the script. I mean, are you afraid that people are going to break in on you? Do you carry that fear around?
No, not consciously.
Is it your fear or is it your parents' fear?
I think it must be my parents.
Right.
I probably a lot at my family, though, because I will hear them talk about it as well. So it's very much in our psyche.
Well, I mean, if everybody was raised like that, then naturally it would be. Mm. But, you know, stop giving it energy. Mm. And after a while, things will dissipate. You know, if you pull the plug out on a fan that's going full speed, it'll go for a while. And then it'll stop because you're not feeding it anymore. Same idea. Again, you know, it's, you got to be careful who you hang out with. Well, not your parents per se, but I got to be careful how I say this. You have to be careful who you hang out with because, you know, people project their fears on each other. It doesn't matter what their relationships are, they do that. And it's not so good. I think that's related to that. Was it Jason Statham that was the guy with the silencer on the arm, or?
Yeah, he's
looking
within the house. No, I don't know who he was. He was
just the usual
fellow that comes along, really, in the dreams. Okay. Same guy all the time, or what? Yeah, I never really see a face. It's just the presence of him.
Okay. So, I thought we might talk a little bit about... anybody got any good stories you want to share with us today? Any spiritual experiences? Coincidence says serendipitous events. Serendipitous, you know this word? Serendipity? You know where it comes from? It comes from Sanskrit. And of course, yoga and mantra all comes from Sanskrit. Sanskrita. What does Sanskrita mean? Sanskrit. It means perfected. Made perfect. And serendipity is kind of anglicized or changed. It comes from Sharana Dvipa. Sharana Dvipa. Sharana means shelter. And Dvipa means island or place. So serendipity means to take shelter of God in the greater sense. Or to go to the place where one can find shelter. That's a divine place. That's where you go to find shelter. You go to God. Where God lives or exists, or that state of mind. So serendipity means a coincidental event or occurrence that what? Lands in your lap that you don't expect necessarily, and it's very positive or very favorable.
There's a film called Serendipity.
Yeah, I'm sure there probably is.
I remember the cafe in London, Manhattan.
Mm.
The queue out for miles. Just a little cafe, I've said, what's they don't serve like alcohol. It's tea, coffee, and light refreshments, and desserts to die for.
Well, that's. I was waiting to hear what was the thing they queued for. They're not queuing for coffee in Manhattan.
And the hot dogs are like marvelous. With the desserts, I went there with my two daughters, and we had one dessert between us, and we couldn't even finish it.
Wow.
But it's a really popular thing that it's featured in the film as well. And the film was about coincidence. It was about two people falling in love, and a book, I think it was. And if they find a book again, then they'll know they're for each other.
Oh, yeah. I think you know what you're
thinking.
No, I think it was my client, the British girl. What's her name? I can't remember her name. I haven't talked to her for a while. Okay. Catherine Zeta-Jones? No, she's not my client. Pardon?
Liz Hunt.
No. I can see her face in my mind.
Is it Marcia Tomei?
No. No. She used to play all these period pieces, and then she sort of moved to America and went Hollywood. What's her name now? Can't think of it. Okay. Yeah, I could just probably find it in a minute if I go look for it. Human ideas are either mental or spiritual. They're a product of the mind, or they're a product of spirit. The mental idea is defective, as it has its relation to the created principle of matter, material world. The spiritual idea is certainly the nearest approach to the Supreme Being, or to divinity. So let's look at that first statement that he's making here. In the material world, humans are subject to four kinds of faults, or four kinds of flaws. The first one is that we are prone to making mistakes. Who here has made no mistakes in your lifetime? Please raise your hand if you've never made a mistake. There's one person here. For the benefit of the people listening to this on the internet, there's one gentleman here who has raised his hand. He's laughing. He's kidding us. Okay, so humans are subject to making mistakes. So that means the mind can have mistaken notions. The second thing is we can become illusioned, which is also another way of saying mistaken notion. We can assume one thing to be something which it isn't. Invariably illusioned. We're not seeing clearly. We can become confused or bewildered. That's the second flaw. The third flaw is we have imperfect senses. How do you know? If I look up in the sky tonight, I won't see the moon because there is no moon. It's the new moon. But if I look up into the sky and look at the moon or the sun, they appear to be this big. Tiny. But are they that big in reality? No. But I can go like this and put my fingers right around the moon if I go like that. So this is called imperfect senses. We cannot measure the vastness of something simply by using our senses. It's not possible. And the fourth flaw of the mind, what he's saying, is the cheating propensity. People have a propensity to cheat, to not tell the truth, to fudge the truth, to tell you what they want you to hear, what they want you to know, what they want you to think, to tell you who won the election, even though they didn't count the ballots, for example. So, because of these four things, the mind can never be, or the mental platform, or the mental principle, can never be taken as an authoritative source. It's not that it can't be proven or verified. In some cases it can be, but just to take it like that as authoritative is not recommended. So we have to raise up to spirit somehow or other. Then again, the spiritual idea, now he's analyzing the spiritual idea of Bhagavan. Bhagavan is what? What's Bhagavan? God. It's God who possesses so many different qualities. That's what Bhagavan means. So if we think of the spiritual idea of God, of Bhagavan, we look at that, that is of two kinds, or has two distinct viewpoints. On the one hand, the person is overpowered by his majesty. And on the other, his personal beauty, God's personal beauty, overpowers his majesty. Allahu Akbar. What does that mean? The Muslims chant it 5 times a day. And they have the beautiful, beautiful singers that they sing it from the minarets. It's really something. The good singers that sing it. Allahu Akbar. God is great. Don't we all in Christian theology, in Judaism, in Islam, in most religions that you will find in the Near East and the West, all look at God from the point of view of God is great. He's powerful. He's awesome. He's majestic. So we look at him with awe and reverence. Is that legitimate? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Of course it is. So the thesis here, what he's saying here is, but his beauty and his sweetness is even better. It's even better. If you go into a business, a big company, a corporation, and you meet the CEO, the chief executive officer, this man has 100,000 people working for him. 100,000 people. Maybe more. That's a lot. So he's an intimidating figure, because he controls so much. Again, we have awesome power and majesty and authority. But if you get to know him and he becomes your friend and he treats you like a friend and you really like him because he's a really good guy and maybe he makes you laugh and maybe he takes you out and buys you a nice dinner, who knows? Which part would you appreciate more? The fact that he has power and majesty and authority, or the fact that he's your friend and he smiles and you have this heart connection? So, same with God. People in the West don't think about God like this. They only usually think about the power and the majesty. That's right. In one kind, the person is overpowered by his majesty, and in the other, his personal beauty overpowers all his majesty. The first idea is represented in the great Narayan or Vishnu of Vaikuntha. So when you worship Vishnu, which simply means God, but in the Eastern sense, you're worshiping God in the form of his power and majesty. Very formal. You bow down, certain things you do, certain things you don't do. It's formal. If you go into the Catholic Church, you take a little holy water, you cross yourself, then you walk down. I don't know if they still do it. And you, before you sit in the pew, you genuflect. You go down on one knee. Do they still do that? Yeah. Yeah. So, and then at times during the Mass, sometimes you stand, sometimes you sit, sometimes you kneel. So there are rituals, formalities, certain things you do, right? So the first idea representative of Narayan or Vishnu in Vaikuntha, who is the Lord of Lords and the God of Gods. So the same concept that we have of God in the West. The second idea is represented in the all-beautiful Krishna. With Radha. There they are, center stage on the altar, Krishna and Radha. Who is the representative of his Hladini or Ananda superior ecstatic energy. What does that mean? Joy. Happiness. Krishna means the most attractive person. Where? Anywhere. Everywhere. The most attractive person. God in his most attractive form. That when you see him, you go, oh my God, God. And there he is. And what does he do? Well, he's a very casual sort of a guy. Not formal. Plays a flute. He's a musician. Knows quite a few tunes. And he sweeps people away. People, animals, plants. He sweeps them away when he plays. And Radha is the divine feminine. It's the Shakti. It's his energy. Which energy? All of his energies. The energy is always represented by the divine feminine. But particularly, it's his energy in terms of love, joy, enjoyment, and loving exchange, reciprocation. The highest level. Here in the material world, no offense, in relationship, we might fall in love and we might say, oh, she's this and she's this and she's that. Oh my God, I've never met a woman like this. And we hold hands and we kiss. It's wonderful. And then a year goes by, 2 years go by, 3 years go by. Do you still hold hands, kiss? Oh, sure. How often? Well, once in a while. Because, do they love each other less? No. Not necessarily. Because in the material world, things wane. They fall off. They discontinue. They wear down. Anybody want to argue that point? It's true. I'm talking about loving and kissing and holding hands, but it's true for anything. No? But not for them. Not for Radha and Krishna. Not in the spiritual world. Things don't wane and fall off and lose their sheen and you know, they don't. What do? They do the opposite. They wax. They increase. They get better. They get more intense. They get more joyful. They get more wonderful. It gets better and better and better. Now, you can imagine that in your mind, but, you know, give me one example in your life where that's happened. You know, I know I should say, maybe you're good at doing certain things like your job or maybe playing music, and you can say that, you know, I play piano. I don't, but I play piano, and over the years I've gotten better and better and better. That's possible. But apart from something like that, you still understand what I'm saying here. Things fall off. But in the spiritual world, they don't. And things fall off so far down to what? To we die. Our bodies fall off. Our bodies start to get old and they start to get aches and pains and sometimes they get diseased and, you know. This is to show you that this is not the ultimate destination, simply. Because nobody wants to die and nobody wants to get old. Nobody wants disease. Nobody wants to suffer. So anyway, back to Radha and Krishna. This is unbridled joy. And it doesn't end. So you can enter into a relationship with God in terms of majesty and formality, awesome power and authority, fine. Or you can enter into relationship with God in terms of familiarity, informality, friendship, fun, playing, joy, goofing around. That's available. Most people honestly don't know that that's available. But it is. When a soul looks inward, because where are we always looking? We're always focused outside of ourselves, aren't we? Will I find happiness here? I'm going to go to this party on Friday. It's supposed to be good. And you go to the party. Have you been to good parties? Sure. Have you been to miserable, lousy parties? Oh, yeah. It's supposed to be good. I hope it'll be good. Because, hell, I got to drive 50 miles. I hope it's good. And it's not good, you know. So the point is, we're always focused outward. We're always looking for our fulfillment outside of ourselves. Now, that's not a criticism. But it's human nature. When the soul looks inward, it obtains its spiritual rasa. What is a rasa? Bliss. It's a taste or a flavor or a mellow or bliss or experience. And the rasa that we're trying to enjoy, this taste we're trying to have in, of enjoyment in the material world, which is only a reflection of the spiritual reality. It's not the real reality. Otherwise, if it was, it wouldn't end. It'd be eternal. So what we're trying to enjoy here is kind of a reflection that wanes in proportion to the development of the spiritual taste. The more you develop your spiritual taste, your spiritual focus, your spiritual rasa, your relationship with God, the less the material enjoyment or the need for material enjoyment has a hold on you. So one waxes in proportion to the other one waning. Right? Any questions about that? Okay. I think we'll leave that there. So that's what, you know, to know God in the personal sense, intimately, in familiarity and love and joy and sweetness, then that's why God is manifested in this particular form as Krishna. That's what that form is for. There are many forms of formality, formal forms that God has manifested in as well. So the ideal thing is to pick what you like and meditate on that, to pick what works for you. Because, you know, in the Vedic tradition, God has 1,000 forms and 1,000 names. I mean, really, what that means is it's unlimited. There's no, you can't pigeonhole God. All right. So let's do a little meditation. Get comfortable, please. Close your eyes. Breathe. Relax. And let go. Deeply, deeply relax and let go. Allow the fear, apprehension to drain from your body. Let it go. Deeply, deeply relax and let go. High above is a beautiful beam of radiant pearl white light, coming down, down, all the way down, entering through the top of your head, expanding throughout your head, your torso, your arms and legs, out the bottom of your feet and into the earth below. Breathe, relax. and let go. Deeply relax. All right. You're in a beautiful, beautiful garden. It is verdant and lush and filled with so many different plants and trees and flowers and insects and a few birds, and it is vibrant with life. It's a beautiful, beautiful day. It's warm and pleasant. And right in the middle of this garden, right in the center point of the mandala, is a round water fountain. And it's raised up. It's not on the ground. It's raised up. It's got a little pedestal underneath it. So it might be up to your waist or maybe a little higher. And it's not very deep. Maybe it's in white marble or alabaster or something like that. And it's filled with water. And the water is absolutely still, unmoving. So you walk up to the edge of the fountain, and you look down into it. What do you see there? Do you see what you expect to see? Your reflection? If you do, that's fine. Now, stand up again, meaning don't look in the fountain for a moment. Now let's ask to be shown what it is you need to see when you look into the fountain again. What is it in your life that you need to see, to acknowledge? Look down again into the fountain, into the water. This time, what do you see? How do you feel about what you're seeing? What effect does it have on you? All right, look up again. And now, the next time we look in, we're going to see what we need to change in our lives. What do we need to change? What one single quality or one single circumstance or situation do we need to change? Look down into the fountain, into the water again. What do we need to change? What do you see? Can you make this change? Will you make this change? Do you want to make the change? How will you change? All right, continue with the meditation. If you've not finished these steps, if you have finished, slowly now returning to consciousness, awakening, feeling refreshed, relaxed, and at peace. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes. All right.